Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust way back in 2002, has been broadcast on community radios in Preston, Swindon and St Albans, and here in Bristol on BCFM. This week, we hear about the Bristol Homeless Property Fund. Kevin Boylan, our investigative hack, is back to tell us all about what he's been discovering through Freedom of Information requests and other things. And Carl Mann's here, who's been helping out directly the homeless here in Bristol. The amazing thing being, he's homeless himself. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, who are just off Jamaica Street. Call them on 0117 909 6897 or visit them on the web at prsc.org.uk. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. But we start this week with Kevin Boylan welcoming him back. You were back here in January, Kevin, weren't you, talking about this?
In January, I was first talking about this subject, yes.
Yeah, but you've found out more since. You've been digging you're actually working on a gold seam, I think, of the story. So tell us, what is the Bristol Homeless Property Fund? Why is it interesting? Why is it important?
Well, the Property Investment Fund for the homeless was entered into last year in November by Bristol City Council. They put £5 million into a pot.
Did they start the fund themselves? They've started some sort of organisation with trustees or whatever. What is this?
Yeah, well, they went into the fund with it's joint funding, so they're getting support from so £5 million goes in from Bristol City Council, and £5 million goes in from the government's investment scheme, which is called Big Society Capital.
Okay, so who's actually running the fund? Is it some trustees? Is it people appointed by the mayor?
It's run by a group called Real Lettings, and Real Lettings are a combination of St Mungo's Homeless Charity and Residence Capital Management Company.
Okay. So what have you found out about these people? I suppose we should start by saying, how much money of our money have they got now?
Well, they've got £5 million of Bristol City Council money.
There you go, that's our money, yeah.
Yep. And £5 million of
government money that still
hasn't been invested in.
But they've got £10 million in the pot of public money. And do we know how much of it they've spent? What they intend to do with it?
The last I've heard about it is that they're intending to buy the properties this month.
Okay, so they're buying places for the homeless.
Basically, I discovered that it wasn't being covered by the Financial Conduct Authority, the FCA, this agreement. So I wanted to find out some more information about it. Well, they got back to me at the end of January, and they said that there are basically two types of collective investment schemes. Now, a collective investment scheme is a pooled investment or fund that several people contribute to. In this case, in Bristol City Council case, it's £5 million from Bristol City Council and £5 million from Big Society Capital. But there's also what's known as an unregulated collective investment scheme. So I wanted to find out because the Bristol one is unregulated, and I wanted to find out exactly what that means. So I got on to the FCA.
Because they're the regulators, aren't they? Financial Conduct Authority are supposed to keep an eye on all this to make sure it's all done above board and there's no favours for friends and money isn't disappearing in people's back pockets and in brown envelopes.
Exactly. So they got back to me, and this is a quote. It says, if a CIS, that being the collective investment scheme, is not authorised or recognised, it is considered an unregulated collective investment scheme, or UCIS. UCIS are not subject to the same restrictions in terms of their investment powers and how they are run. In a UCIS, you will not be permitted automatic access to the Financial Ombudsman Service or the Financial Services Compensation Scheme if something goes wrong. And there was a link to the FCA website where they had a page on the UCIS, and there's a bit more there, and it continued. UCIS use is rising, particularly in the less common fields of investment such as forestry, film production, and foreign property. And then investment in a UCIS is, here we go, another quote, not recommended as UCIS, by their very nature, are risky products. We are taking direct action against several firms and advisors involved in the sale of UCIS. So that was what I got from the FCA themselves.
They say they're taking action. They say they're taking action there.
Well, they are taking action against several firms and advisors who have been involved in the sale of these schemes.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because they're saying they don't regulate it, but they're still taking action. So they're obviously concerned that sorts of schemes are wide open to abuse.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. But the answer I received, because I brought this up to I took this to the. To the PR service manager of Bristol City Council, Tim Morritt.
PR, so what does that mean? PR? Public relations.
Public relations, yeah. For Bristol City Council. And he said that although the fund is not regulated, the financial management company for the fund, Resonance, are covered. Right, so then I decided I'd follow up with Resonance and Real Lettings. Now, I spoke to a woman called Sharon Smallworth. She's their communications manager. This is at Resonance. I spoke to her on the phone. And she sent me an email saying that in relation to my inquiries, she was dependent on the financial staff to get back to me. And that was the last I heard from her. Basically, when I phoned up again, I didn't get her anymore. I was getting this person came on the phone. He said he was the IT guy.
And, did he give his name?
And I think he called himself Martin or something.
Okay.
Right. Now I phoned up a couple of times and I got this IT guy, and always the staff weren't in the office, but on one occasion I did phone up and he seemed to be saying that they were there, so he said I'll go and get them. Now these are two people.
Let's just be clear here. This is at Resonance, is it?
Resonance. Yeah. This is at Resonance. Yes. This is now they're based in Bristol. Right, and there's a guy called Simon Chisholm, and he is the investment director, and there's John Williams, who's the investment manager. John Williams apparently has spent the majority of his career working in the investment and corporate and banking sector of the City of London.
Oh dear.
Specialising within investment appraisal for such deals as management buyouts, mergers, acquisitions and property investment.
Don't tell me he was removed in 2008, so he came to Bristol.
Well, I couldn't tell you about that, but anyway, this is the person who should have got on to me. And I've been trying again and again to get through to. Eventually, I was told that he was in the office, and the IT guy went to go and get him, and then he came back and he said, "Oh, he seems to be away from his desk." So I'm still waiting. In the meantime, I got onto Real Lettings, who are based in London. They don't even have a Bristol office as yet. Anyway, Real Lettings is the is the it's basically St. Mungo's. It's they're working in conjunction with Resonance, and I made some inquiries there. I said, could somebody get back to me because I'm worried about what the FCA said and stuff, and she said this is Susan Fallis, who is the director of Real Lettings. I got an email from her on February 10th. And she CC'd me in to John Williams, the investment manager of Resonance, as I've just said, saying that I would get a reply from him. I'm still waiting. So that gives you an idea. And then I started to have a look at Big Society Capital. Now, Big Society Capital is the government, as I've said already, is the government's independent social investment institution. It's descended from the Social Investment Task Force set up by Gordon Brown in 2000. It changed its name in 2011, and four of the main banks are invested in it: Barclays, HSBC, Lloyds, and the RBS, the Royal Bank of Scotland. The founding chairman of Big Society Capital is a chap called Ronald Cohen. Now, in addition to his many financial and business posts that he has acquired, Mr. Cohen is called the father of British venture capital. And he's also a director of the British Museum and is on the executive committee of the International Institute of Strategic Studies, a widely reputed international affairs think tank in Arundel House, London. So, anyway, Mr. Cohen was also, I discovered, he was chairman of Apax Venture Capital Firm at the time of the Apax-owned British United Shoe Machinery pension collapse in 2000. Which left 544 workers, many of them long service, without a pension. And some MPs kicked up a stink about it at the time, including Edward Garnier, Patricia Hewitt, and Ashok Kumar. And in 2007, the GMB Trades Union, they blamed private equity firms for the collapse of 96 pension funds and linked Cohen with losses totaling $81 million at Dexion, British United Shoe Machinery, and USM Texon. Both Bristol City Council and Real Lettings told me that they couldn't comment on the behaviour or reputations of individuals. So I'm not getting any answers on that front. But it seems a bit dubious that this guy is the head of the Big Society Capital.
Now, we've got a lot of different organisations there, Kevin. £10 million. Just remind us how I'll just run through them. We've got Bristol City Council, in a way, at the centre of this spider's web, because they've created this new organisation. We've got Resonance, we've got Real Lettings, we've got St Mungo's and Big Society Capital. Can you just remind us, explain how those four fit together?
Right, well, St Mungo's and Resonance have come together to form Real Lettings. Right,
it was a
scheme which started off in London. It's been going for a couple of years in London. And now they're trying to expand it outwards. And Oxford is already part of it. And Bristol is the second.
I could put you on some councillors in Oxford, maybe, that might be able to tell you how it's been going there. What they think of it.
Yeah. So there you go. That's and then Big Society, basically the scheme involves the local council investing half of the money into the property that's going to be used for the homeless, to house the homeless for a period. It's not It's only for a short period. It's only for 2 or 3 years, and then they're supposed to be motivated enough at the end of that to get back into the private renting.
Is there any
sector.
Specific person who's a sort of go-to director of real lettings? Someone who's a spokesperson for it all? Because if there is, they don't seem to have been in touch with you.
Well, Real Lettings is the director is Susan Fallis, who she did actually communicate with me, but she and she CC'd in John.
Yeah, but
Williams.
Did she actually answer your questions?
Well, not really. She passed the buck onto John Williams.
And John Williams is the disappearing man, really, who keeps... Yeah. He's supposedly at his desk. We think he might be at his desk. He's allegedly at his desk today, sir. But anyway, so I think, you know, you definitely deserve the Chris Searle Award for That's Life. Because this is an absolute farce here, that they've set up this UCIS. Just remind us what that stands for.
It's an unregulated collective investment scheme.
Yes, this super dodgy UCIS, unregulated collective investment scheme, with all these dodgy people involved, people that don't want to come to the phone,
yeah.
And that have also been connected with massive collapses of pension funds,
yes.
And it's all public money. So when public money is involved, and I know the law, you do have to actually declare publicly where it's been spent and who it's been spent by. So these people not coming to the phone is an immediate red flag to me.
Well, it is. It's a big red flashing light.
Yes, great big on the top of the Colston Tower. Carl, do you want to come in here?
Yeah, I'm going to defend St Mungo's because they're just the puppet in all this. They're going to be the fall guys. If when this all goes wrong, it's going to be St Mungo's charity, which is the biggest charity for the homeless. Shelter does great stuff to help prevent homelessness, but St Mungo's are on the front line. And I have had my problems with St Mungo's, but I am going to defend them on this one, is that they are just the puppet. And when everything goes wrong, they are going to be the
it's
ones.
It's almost like these other organisations, Resonance or Real Lettings or Big Society Capital, have now got their hooks into St Mungo's. So when things go wrong, St Mungo's going to be tarred with that brush. Carl, great that you could come in at such short notice onto Dialect to talk about your charity you've set up. But before you do that, can you tell us a bit about yourself, how you ended up homeless?
Yeah, bad relationship, split up from my wife. I lived on a barge. My barge went up in flames. Found myself with nowhere to live, basically. I was moored between Bristol and Bath. I went to Bath to declare myself homeless, and they basically said, because I don't pay council tax on a barge, you've not got a local connection.
Well, you haven't got a financial investment in. You haven't been paying us,
yes.
So you've nothing to do with us anymore.
Yeah, so go to Bristol.
So how does that work? You have to. I mean, if you're in a situation where, say, as you were, you're living near Bath, but you're within the Bath area, so you do have a local connection. But you say you go to the Bath local authority in Bath, North East Somerset, I think it is, isn't it? Yeah. You go there and you say, "Well, I've got a local connection. I really need some help finding somewhere to live." And they say, "No, you haven't." What's that about? How on earth do you then find somewhere that you do have a local connection for?
Well, there's only three councils in the UK now that do it, and that's Bristol, Manchester, and a borough of London. So they're the only three councils what give you a local connection if you're not from the area. So I was pointed to Bristol.
So, okay, so you came to Bristol. What did they do? They say, gave you somewhere to live straight away?
Oh, I wish. I was actually walking from Bath to Bristol, having to stop every 5 minutes to pop blisters on my feet, thinking, well, this is going to be worth it because I'm going to get to Bristol and they're going to say, hello, welcome to Bristol. Come, I'll give you a house or, you know, a flat or something like that. The reality is they turned around to me and said, you've got no local connection. You've got to build up a local connection. That means you've got to be on the street for 6 months. And because you're fit and healthy and no addictions, then it could take us 2 to 3 years to house you. So I was looking potentially at, well, I'm still looking potentially at 3.5 years of being homeless before they will help me. But if I had a drug or alcohol addiction, I'd be at the top of the list.
Did you think about faking a drug and alcohol addiction? I mean, a lot of people must, or even saying, well, sod it, I'm going to start boozing like crazy so I can get somewhere to live.
Well, that's what happens. You come on the streets clean, you think that the council's going to help you, you know, duty of care and all this, that and the other, and then to be told that you're going to be on the streets for 6 months, and if you're clean, you're going to be on the streets for a hell of a lot longer than that. But if you had an addiction, the help will be there for you. So people who's at the lowest ebb, who's lost everything from a bad relationship or whatever else they've come, whatever reason they've come on the streets for, nobody comes on the streets because they want to. To be told that you know, if you had an alcohol addiction or a drug addiction, that you get through, be fast tracked through, then yeah, of course you're going to go out on the street and go, I'm going to have a drink, and that one drink turns to two drinks, turns to all day drinking, turns to drugs. Next thing you know, you've got a massive problem again. And as I said, you know, our poster boys of homelessness are the alcoholics and the drug addicts. You know, the aggressive beggars, because that's what you see on the streets. You could walk past me, you wouldn't know I was homeless. And there's hundreds of people you walk past every day on the streets of Bristol who are homeless, are sofa surfing, and you don't know that they're there.
How do you cope with just the sort of basics, like, you know, not having a toilet, not having, you know, anywhere to wash? How do you manage?
Well, we go to...
Because it's about keeping your dignity a bit as well.
Yeah, it's pride and everything. So, you know, for toilets, we go... You know, I don't know if they're going to end up closing them down because I say this, but Cabot Circus is great for toilets and you can have a wash in there. Pret a Manger are very good with the homeless. They let you go in, you know, go to the toilet and everything. McDonald's are also good. You know, I don't want to name drop, but, you know.
So you're basically able to places. Go to high street places to use the loo.
Well, free.
Yeah.
And the galleries, if you know, if you're around that area.
Tell me a bit more about you, because do you have the sort of skills that where in the, if you had somewhere to live, you would maybe had to get a job? Have you got experience? Have you got qualifications?
I've got a degree in engineering. I was an engineer for 15 years at Toyota. And I'm a HGV driver as well, so I've got the qualifications, I've got everything there. I haven't got an address, so I can't work.
I mean, were you working at the time you got made homeless? How did that all happen?
I was making trinket boxes out of pallet wood and selling to the tourists. And so, you know, on the barge. But over the winter, I used to go to the agency and either drive or, you know, be an engineer at some factory over the Christmas period and this, that and the other, just to get some money, because I used to save the money up I was making from the trinket boxes to see me through the, you know, the when the tourists... I've gone basically over the winter period and then do that to top up as well so I could survive and not claim any benefits or anything like that. And yeah, that all went up in flames really.
What about your charity you've set up? Why did you think it was necessary to set something like that up?
Because the system doesn't work. Simple as, the system doesn't work. The council have got a duty of care for everybody from Bristol City area. Bristol City Council have got a duty of care, so they have a scheme called the No Second Night Out, which doesn't work because there's lots of people who have more than one night out, more than 1 month out. But they have a duty of care to rehouse you. But the people who are not from this area, from other areas, and the reason people come to Bristol is because if you're broke from a relationship and it's a long-term relationship, you find that your friends and your partner's friends are all one, so you don't want to put on them. And you don't want your family to see that you're on the streets. That's so you move to a city where you're not known. And then, you know, Bristol's one of those places where at least you can get a local connection. That's one good thing about it. And you can get food, which is, you know, Bristol's brilliant for food and for getting, you know, clothes handed out and sleeping bags and even tents.
But you mean there are people who are feeding the homeless, or you can shoplift, or what? What do you mean by it's good for food?
They've got the Wild Goose, which is a calf, which is free food. There's Pip and Jay's, which do a soup run. There's lots of little charities, little organisations what do Food Not Bombs, brilliant organisation. They use waste food. What the shops are just about ready to throw out, and they cook amazing food from that. And
you might be cold, but you won't starve.
You won't starve in Bristol. You will not starve in Bristol, and there's no reason to be cold in Bristol, really. I.e., you can get sleeping bags and blankets and things like that. It's just finding shelter, which is the problem. and the basic human needs of toilets and showers and places, you know.
So what are what are you doing with the charity then?
Well, we directly raise money from, we've got a few funding sites, and we go out with yellow collection boxes on the streets of Bristol, raise money and that money directly goes and pays for a deposit and a month's rent in advance to a private landlord, unfortunately, because the council's got no houses. And we take somebody off the streets, we help them with counselling if they need counselling, we help them get employment, we help them build their lives back up. And I use the word hope a lot because we're giving them hope for the future. You know, somebody's small gesture of kindness goes a long way when you're on the streets, you know. Not everybody wants you to put your hand in your pocket and chuck them a pound. Some people just want you to say hello.
How are you managing to raise money, though, for your charity?
I've got a GoFundMe site, which is on my Facebook site. There's links there. And also I've got an EasyFund site, which is an app which if you go shopping online or anything like that, if you eBay, Amazon, or, you know, Argos, Asda, the whole lot, there's 3,000 retailers on there. If you go through the app and you've picked us as your charity of choice, then every time you shop, it's no cost to you. It doesn't cost you anything extra, but the retailers actually give us a donation. Asda, if you get a delivery from, you shop at Asda and you get a delivery, you still pay the £5 delivery charge, but they then donate that £5 to us.
Okay, so what's that app? Or what's
it's an easy fundraising app. It's all on my website. If you go on to www.homelesspayitforward.com, there's links.
Say that again. Homelesspayitforward.com.
Yeah.
What's the meaning of that?
Right,
homeless pay
here
it forward.
We go.
Where's this?
The pay it forward. Everybody asked me this. The pay it forward bit is a concept from an American guy who was 11 years old. It was a social studies thing, and the teacher gave them a task of, if you could do one thing, how would you change the world? And this he's a little genius. Well, he was. He's unfortunately dead now. He came up with the concept of doing three people a favour, something what they can't manage to do themselves. It might be a small thing, it might be a massive thing. And instead of them owing him the favour, they would pay that favour forward and help another three people, so that three would breed into nine, and vice versa.
Sounds like a sort of reverse Ponzi scheme, reverse pyramid selling scheme.
Well, it is. It's a utopian way of life, isn't it, if it all works. But we're homeless. The three of us in the charity, there's five of us in the charity, but three of us are still homeless, and we're doing what we can, and we're paying it forward and doing something massive what they, you know, other homeless can't do for themselves. And then we just say to them, as soon as we've housed three people, we don't want you to come and praise us for doing it. Just go and help somebody else. Go and help, you know,
and of course,
whatever it is.
If you've got a stable place to live, that is that much easier, isn't it?
Yeah.
What about things in the real world, though? Fundraising through apps is one thing. What about, events, real events that people can go to?
Yeah, we've got a 50s night coming up on the 14th of May. That's at Ashton Vale Community Hall. Tickets go on sale on the 1st of March. The price, £15 a ticket. We've got a live rockabilly band coming in. We've got a DJ doing all the 50s music, so it's going to dress up in the 50s gear, be all glam and go for a jive.
Sounds almost like you've applied your engineering degree to the problem of homelessness. You know, you're looking at all the various problems. Hang on a minute. If we just connected that up with that, and you've engineered a potential solution here, maybe.
Well, that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to do it. You know, it gets difficult some days. Some days you feel like you're banging your head against a wall, especially when, people have gone out. I've been out standing in the streets with my yellow box going, "Can you please help the homeless get a home?" and been out there for 7 hours and only raised £6.
Yeah, so there are certain things that the charities do which is just kind of temporarily plugging the gap. Yeah. The real difficulty is finding a permanent solution to it. Yeah. In a world where we're in a property bubble as well, where the actual price of property is going through the roof, and more people are taking their money out of the stock exchange, out of banks, and putting it into property, some even leaving it empty. You know, it's just an investment. It's like money in the bank. So, you know, we're living in a very unreal world where property is something much more than somewhere to live now.
Well, yeah, the bankers do that every year when they get their big fat bonuses. What they do is, instead, so they don't have to pay the tax on the bonus, they go and buy a load of properties from their bonus, then remortgage those properties and get the money back into their bank. And because it's on a mortgage, you don't pay tax on debt.
Oh, they are sneaky. Oh, that's interesting. Interesting. I've never heard that before, but that's a fascinating. They are such banksters. You know, you were talking, Kevin, just now about this unregulated CIS, and it does remind me of a trial that took place in the City of London in about 1990 and a kind of retrial in 1992, and I'll put a link to it on the show page. It's called the Blue Arrow Trial. At which that trial, it was a stock flotation done by County NatWest Bank, and the evidence was absolutely clear by the police. The police had, fraud squad had gathered the evidence. It was a fraudulent rights issue. So what they'd done is they said X, Y, and Z about the company, which just simply wasn't true, in order to get more and more people to invest in it. And then, of course, the shares started going down pretty much straight away. Anyway, the bankers at County NatWest, some of them what they call blue blood city men, you know, like the top bankers in the city, were on trial, and it was a long drawn out trial, and they got suspended sentences first of all for what was multi-million pound fraud, and then they took it to appeal because, of course, they're bankers, they have plenty of money to pay lawyers. They appealed it. The Court of Appeal overturned the suspended sentence. And talking to this ex-fraud squad copper, Rowan Bosworth Davis, he was in the fraud squad at the time and was involved a bit in the case, he said everybody, the word came down from on high. As those guys got acquitted and there was not even a suspended sentence for them, the word came down from on high, no more prosecutions. There will be no more prosecutions for fraud, for false accounting, anything like that. And of course, if you look at the record, there's been hardly anything. The only prosecutions have been for individual traders, for example, Nick Hayes, who actually was supposed to be in a conspiracy to fix the LIBOR rate. That was just the tail end of last year. And they couldn't find anybody else who was in the conspiracy with him. And he showed at the trial, he actually showed the manual he'd been given at UBS in Switzerland, how to fix the LIBOR rate. And this is what you do as part of your job. So he showed this to the judge, showed it to the jury, but they still convicted him. So you've got this completely criminal banking system now with no real regulation. I mean, the FCA, they're about as tough as it gets, and they haven't really got much in the way of teeth. But anyway, look, let's come back to you, Carl, because you're doing some really amazing work here in the city. What's your dream? How would you like this to end up? What would you like to, you know, what's this all about really for you?
Well, I want to make a dent in the homeless society of Britain, basically, the UK. I'm starting off in Bristol, going to go to Cardiff next, and then Swindon, and I'm going to work my way up. And I'm going to change the way of public perception towards the homeless. And I'm also going to change the way the homeless think of themselves, because they've been beaten and beaten and beaten. If you get told that you're going to amount to nothing for long enough, you start believing that, and unfortunately that's the case in many cases. And I'm going to show them that there's hope, there is a light at the end of the tunnel. It's not somebody who's carrying a torch to bring them more harm or anything, but there's actually a light, and we can change this.
Because there seems to be almost a kind of spirit of victimisation around at the moment, particularly here in Bristol, with Nick Hooper at the City Council saying when they leave their tents during the day, we are going to confiscate them, this kind of thing in the local paper. I'd like to see him try.
Yeah, he's stopped the Mungo Centre, the Compass Centre, just around the corner here, giving out sleeping bags, because that's promoting homelessness.
And he says he wants the homeless to be visible, which is rather sinister. I mean, does that mean you have to be seen in a shop doorway rather than in a tent? I find this a bit scary. Anyway, great. More power to your elbow, Carl.
Thank you.
Just give us some contact details for your website again, and Facebook or social media, whatever you want.
My website is www.homelesspayitforward, that's all one word, .com. My Facebook site is just homeless, that's two separate words. and you will see a green tent with a woman sitting outside of it. My contact number is 07459 412 418. If anybody wants to ring me or text me for more details, I'll give you the details. There's, if you go on to Bristol Post as well, who's in Bristol Post, and if you look for my name on the Bristol Post, you'll see their interview, and they've got a link to our direct to our Facebook site as well. That's one thing to do, and all our fundraising sites are on our Facebook site, so there's all links there. And yeah, and if you ever see us out in the street with little collection tubs, which you see on shop counters, the yellow ones with homeless paid for, don't be shy to come and talk to us, and don't be shy to put a couple of pence in. I'm not asking anybody to chuck tenners with £20 in there, but, you know, a couple of pence, every penny helps.
Okay, Kevin Boylan and Carl Mann, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
And now I'm joined by Belinda Kirk, who's the founder of Explorers Connect here in Bristol. Hi, Belinda. Welcome to Dialect.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us, what is Explorers Connect?
It's at the moment, it's Britain's biggest adventure community. So it was set up essentially to help people have more adventures, because that's what I think everyone should be doing.
Okay, so you say an adventure community. Is this online? Is it sort of people talk to each other?
So it started online. Now it's sort of 20,000 people that read our newsletters about how you can go and have adventures. But also in Bristol and London, we have sort of several thousand people who are in our sort of main two hubs. And we run events, we have speaker events where adventurers come and talk and share amazing stories and hopefully inspire. We also run activities like kayaking in the tunnels under Bristol is one of my new favourites, to Kilimanjaro, you know, climbing mountains overseas. So,
but do you have sort of a danger star rating for your adventures? Because, I mean, it's not really much fun having an adventure if there's no danger at all, is it?
We don't have a danger star rating. I think the way that people assess danger is maybe not accurate because of the world that we live in nowadays. I think a lot of things that might look dangerous, actually, if they're done properly, especially things we do, obviously we have to do them for groups that we're responsible for, so we do things incredibly safely. But if you were going off and doing your own adventure, how you would assess your risk and the danger involved, I think that's a good lesson to learn in life, and I think that's what we've lost by not having enough adventures, is that taking risks, assessing risk, and realising that risks are a really important part of living and part of life. I think that's something that's one of the main reasons I think people should have adventures.
Well, I'm thinking health and safety. Hang on a minute. Have you filled in all the forms? Because the health and safety, it's almost like you can't have an adventure with health and safety, because you've got to make sure that all the boxes are ticked, and there certainly can't be any danger.
I completely agree. We are living in a world that is risk averse, where our kids are cotton wooled, and people don't take responsibility for their own safety. I think health and safety has sort of is a massive. It's incredibly important when running things and looking after people, but it also stands in the way of people taking responsibility and pushing themselves in the ways that they can. Because if you go and have your own adventure, there is no health and safety. There's no one you have to. There's no forms you have to fill in, and that's what I want Explorers to Connect to do more and more, is to enable people to go and have their own adventures.
So why is adventure important? What's the positive? Why do you think it's so necessary?
I could talk for hours on that subject. I think, to try and paraphrase a whole load of years of research that I've done into this, if you look at just the simple fact that all the studies show that the people who live in urban centres versus people who live outside of urban centres, They have higher depression rates, higher mental illness. There are higher levels of physical health, like obesity and so on. And that is because we're not connected to nature enough, as well as this whole risk taking. So the activity side of adventure is really important for health. I think that's quite obvious. You know, obesity and heart disease and all of those things.
Yeah, exercise. We don't get enough of it.
No, and that's because we're sat in front of screens the whole time.
Yeah, or in the car.
Yeah, or in the car. Yeah. But there's also things that are less obvious, but there is so much research been done on it and loads more coming, and also that I've seen for myself in 20 years of taking people into the wilderness, that it changes people's lives. It makes them happier. It makes them nicer, amazingly. So one of my favourite studies that I quote a lot is that these American scientists put these two sets of groups, immersed one in nature, a nature environment, another into a man-made environment, and they tested their intrinsic and extrinsic aspirations. So your intrinsic aspirations are things like well-being, connectedness, your happiness. This is directly linked to your happiness levels, what your aspirations are. Your extrinsic aspirations are things like money, fame, and looking good. And this one study found that, and so do many other studies, they found that the people immersed in a nature environment while asked these questions or going through these tests were very much more, their intrinsic aspirations, i.e. their aspirations to be happy and to be well connected, to be connected to others. These were all incredibly high in people who'd spent a lot of time in the nature environment. Whereas those who spend time in the man-made environment, they were like off the scale, all into money, fame, and looking good. And they even went a step further, these scientists, and they did this generosity study whereby they're given $5 and then they can either choose to give $5 back to this hidden person who can then give you, anyway, it was a study in generosity. And again, they found out that the people who were immersed in the nature environment were really, really generous. And the people who had been immersed in a man-made environment became really greedy, basically. And I think that I think we all know that we all kind of connect with that and think, yeah, I get that. I understand that. But now there's actually all this evidence coming out that really supports it and kind of, I think, amplifies it.
That live out in the countryside, out in the middle of nowhere, often just get cabin fever. They start going nuts as well, don't they? I mean, at least in the city, you've got lots of people around you.
I think that idea about having lots of people around you, actually, you can be lonelier with lots of people around you than you can be on your own. And I haven't looked into it in depth, but I'm sure I've heard about some studies of that. If you actually look at our modern society and us all living in our cities, there are more people living on their own now than ever before. And those people who are living on their own show much higher anxiety, depression, and so on. I mean, we're not supposed to live as, you know, on our own in boxes looking at screens all day.
Okay, so you do something called the Base Camp Festival. What's that?
So the Base Camp Festival is another of my projects that I absolutely love. It's all about inspiring people to have more adventures. It is essentially like a music festival, but in the daytime you try loads of adventures. So you can climb trees and kayak and cave and all sorts of things. And then in the evening we have inspiring lectures from people who've done adventures. And then a good old, you know, bit of music, and the bar's open later in the evening. So it's a music festival in the evening. And that kind of community feel. But in the daytime, you stay sober and you have loads of, you try loads of, you can be a big kid again.
So I suppose the idea is this could be the starting point for people's adventures outside, you know, with small groups or on their own even.
Absolutely. People have left the festival having, one of the things that I challenge people to do at the festival is to plan their next adventure, whether it be camping out on a hill or whether it be climbing Mount Everest, whatever their level.
But haven't all the adventures been done? I mean, they've been to the Antarctic, the Arctic, up Everest, everywhere. You know, mankind has done all the adventures that you can do.
The thing is, but have you done all the adventures you can do? Because it's not just about mapping the planet, although that can be done by satellite now, and finding out what's in these areas that haven't been explored before. It's actually about an inner exploration. It's about finding out about yourself. It's about finding out and building empathy for other people and building confidence and all of these things that you get out of having adventures.
How about the Wild Nights Out that you organised?
So this is brilliant. I'm so passionate about this. So the when I set up Explorers Connect, which is a social enterprise to help people go out, adults to go outdoors, I've for a few years, probably since the start, I've been really wanting to help kids get outdoors. And the way that I run Thing Explorers Connect, it's really hard to do that. And there are so many struggling charities out there taking kids outdoors as it is. It's made more sense to me to, like, how can we help them? So essentially, it's a gathering of all the adventure community at Explorers Connect to go out and have a National Adventure Day on the 16th of July. And we're going to help people have adventures that night, but everyone is going to donate to the charities that help kids go outside.
What's the point of all this then? What's the point of that? Just fundraising?
The point of Wild Night Out is awareness raising and fundraising. So it's fundraising for the charities. This year it's the Youth Adventure Trust, which does amazing work with disadvantaged and vulnerable children. And they do a three-year program with these children. And it changes these children's lives and their path into life. And also awareness about the fact, like, you know, let's all get outside and do some fun.
I mean, I seem to remember, I mean, this is a long time ago when I was at school, there was quite a lot of this sort of outdoor activity type of thing going on for children, maybe not so much for adults, but has that fallen away from the state school sector? And, you know, are you doing something in a way to sort of try and help pick that up again?
Absolutely. It is heartbreaking, the lack of opportunities that kids have to go outdoors. The statistics are terrifying. The amount of area that kids used to play in the 70s, when we were maybe kids, I don't know, what is now shrunk to 90%, to 10% of that, where kids are allowed to roam wild without, you know, essentially not leaving the site.
Yeah,
of their
we were
parents.
Pretty much unsupervised as youngsters. I mean, from the age of about 7, 8 up, really.
Exactly. We'd all go out, climb trees, fall over, hurt ourselves a bit, but we're better for it. Whereas now kids are cotton walled. They're taken back. I mean, obviously, I'm not saying all
mollycoddled. That's
mollycoddled. Well, we've grown a society where we're all so scared. We've got stranger danger. And this whole health and safety, like we were talking about, this whole problem with
not to mention
blame.
The terrorists around every corner, supposedly.
We're all living in fear, so yeah. We're also projecting that onto our children, they're just not being able to make those mistakes and build those coping mechanisms. So I'm seeing the first of them come through Explorers Connect. People in their 20s, early 20s, mid 20s, who have not been given the opportunity at school or youth clubs, because there's none of them anymore, where they can have those sorts of risks.
It's actually quite worrying, isn't it, that the children haven't had this opportunity, you know, for many of them to, you know, to maybe get things wrong for themselves out and about. Also, they spend a lot of time on WhatsApp, staring into the phones, on video games, indoors.
Well, we have record highs of child obesity, heartbreaking stats about child depression, and the amount of drugs being given to children for depression now is just I know that there's a lot of factors in this, but I do think that getting kids outdoors and having adventures is there's so much evidence that says that will be a major way of alleviating those symptoms, at least.
Sounds brilliant what you're doing. Tell me about some adventures that you've been on, though, because you must have been out there and done something, or probably a few different adventures, which has really made you feel that you want to share this with others. So where have you been? Have you ever done anything, like, dangerous?
Dangerous. I was very lucky. Something, I think it was the Duke of Edinburgh Award at school, and it was being part of Girl Guides, Girl Guides and things like that, set some sort of fire in me. So when I was 18, I went to Africa on my own, travelled round. It changed my life. I don't know what I would have done if I hadn't done that. I might have been quite a normal job. But thank goodness I did, because I came back, and my whole life ever since then has been about looking for my own adventures. And now, in the last sort of 6-7 years, it's been about sharing that more and more. So I've spent, I think over a period of about 14 years, I had a dual career between taking youth development expeditions out all over the world and taking young people from 16 to 21 year olds and seeing time and time again how much the impact, the very positive impact it had on them. And also, bizarrely, well, not bizarrely, but at the same time, I had a career in television in wildlife and adventure films. So I've worked, I used to take Ray Mears and Bear Grylls and people like that, and I would do all the health and safety and all the logistics and so on. And then, yeah, making lots of adventure films. So, and then actually, I should probably mention, I've done loads of my own expeditions and adventures, and I got a Guinness World Record for rowing around Britain in a rowing boat. That's my most recent
adventure. Good God, how long did that take?
52 days. Non-stop.
And how, that's a long way, isn't it? How far?
2,300 miles.
Good God, Belinda. That's absolutely amazing. God, yes, I'm shocked to be in the same room as someone who's done that. That's absolutely outrageous. But have you ever really been close to worried, close to death, or, you know, some...
Of course.
Of course, she says. So, that, well, you know, where, tell us about, you know, sort of your scrapes in these adventures, because, you know, obviously you've got to try and make sure that if you're encouraging others to go on adventures, that they don't end up in these dodgy situations you've been in the past.
I do, but I think everyone, the more you do adventure, you have to take your own decisions
adrenaline?
On what you're going to.
Is it adrenaline? You get adrenaline from danger?
I think in my 20s, I was definitely an adrenaline junkie, definitely. And that was my main focus about getting into adventure. And then as I worked with young people on expeditions, I started thinking about, well, and I know that it changed my life. I started thinking about, well, there's something going on here. And as I was talking about, you know, the connection to nature and taking risks and learning to be able to take your own risks and live your own life. I introduce people to adventure and really want that to be their first steps or reintroduce people into adventure. But I think once people get to the stage where they're doing really big, risky things like that, then obviously that's up. You know, by then they've been very enabled and they're making their own decisions.
Okay, so dangerous situations you've been in, you've put yourself in.
So there's so many, I don't know where to begin. The first trip I talked about when I was 18, okay, so I was completely green. I didn't know anything. And I wasn't arrogant, but I was very stubborn. And so I was got quite scared in Africa at various times, but I wasn't going to go home either. I was nearly sold into the white slave trade in Nairobi.
How did that happen?
It's a long story, but I'm trying to be short.
Yeah.
So I didn't want to hang out with all the other backpackers and so on. I wanted to meet the people of the country and actually learn something about the country. So I met these two ladies in a bar and we spent a really good evening going around the different bars and having chatting and, you know, learning about Nairobi and Kenya and trying to find things out like that. We ended up going into this, what I thought was a kind of club, and up these dark stairs. And I remember thinking something's wrong. And then we ended up that it was actually a brothel. And I obviously at that point realised there was a big problem. And long story short, this hero came out of the environment. He was at a brothel though. Anyway, he came up to me and everyone had been trying to talk to me and this guy, and I was like not talking to anyone, thinking, how am I going to get out of here? And he said, are you okay? And it was the way he said it. I just went, no, I'm not. Da, da, da. Anyway, this guy got all of his mates. Thank goodness for this guy. I wouldn't be here. He got all of his mates. They were all oil workers. They were all Australian oil workers. And they were all big guys. And he got all of his mates in a big gang. And they basically picked me up, arm on each on one arm, and surrounded me. And they went for the door. And the girls that I came with were jumping on the back of them. Their massive fight broke out. And it was a terrifying, obviously, at the time. Anyway, I got back to where I was staying and I was okay. And I wish I'd taken that guy's name or something because he literally saved my life on that day. So that's a bit of an unusual one to begin with, maybe. But on the row, very different. But around Britain, we have the busiest shipping lanes in the world. And we're in a tiny little 24-foot boat. No engine, no sail. So just rowing power. And we would try and dodge across these motorways like a tortoise. And that was okay because we knew we were crossing the shipping lanes. But sometimes the ships went out of the shipping lanes. And if you imagine a Russian tanker in the middle of the night just off the coast of Wick, and us screaming down the radio saying you have to turn because we don't have anything, we don't have the power to turn, the wind's in the wrong way, you have to turn, you're going to run us over, which would have been game over, obviously. And we were screaming down the radio at them, and they turned at the last minute because we were setting off flares and all sorts. And they turned, but they were turned, they were so close, I'm terrible at distances. I don't know. They were 50 metres away, say, and the whole boat nearly tipped over because of the bow wave from them. And I don't know, there was loads of things. I'm just talking really too fast and trying to tell you a few things without boring you.
Okay, one more scrape with death before we say goodbye, Belinda, because it's really, you know, it's a privilege to meet with somebody who hasn't lost this youthful adrenaline rush, wish to actually push the boundaries a little bit, because you're right, too many of us are mollycoddled. So what's your final story?
I was on this program where we were shifting giraffe from an area where they had enough giraffe, essentially, to an area, another national park, where they needed more giraffe. And we had this big fence up that was a temporary fence that we'd put up in order to corral them further and further down into a sort of funneling system. And essentially, the fence broke at one point. These things were stampeding. And the fence broke at some point, and I was stood in the wrong place as this fence happened to just give way. And these stream of giraffe came running past me, and I just remember, I thought, do I lie down? And I was like, no, just stand up so they can see me. And I just stood there, literally, in this stream, and I was just thinking, this could be the end. But somehow they just seemed to avoid me, thankfully.
So they were sort of stepping over you or past you or by the
running.
Side of you. Yeah, running. Oh, gosh. Yeah, okay. Running. Caught in the middle of a stampede of giraffes. That's Belinda Kirk, the one and only. Well, look, Belinda, it's been a real pleasure having you on the show tonight. And maybe you could just remind us, tell us whereabouts people can get hold of Explorers Connect, find you online or phone numbers or whatever.
So the website for Explorers Connect is explorersconnect.com. It's all one word. You can also find details about the charity fundraising night, Wild Night Out, on there under the Explorers Connect
website. What date was that again?
That's on the 16th of July. So if you're going to have any adventure at all this year, and you fancy, like, yeah, I'm going to be with everyone else as a big community of people having adventures that night, put the 16th of July. Sorry, the 16th of July in your diary, and we will send you more information as to how we can help you do that.
Okay, and what about the Wild Night Out, more kiddie-oriented?
And as part of that, you can donate to the Youth Adventure Trust. So okay. That's part of the Wild Night Out adventure.
Website one more time?
explorersconnect.com.
Okay, Belinda Kirk, the founder of Explorers Connect here in Bristol 6 years ago. Yeah?
Yeah, Bristol Company, yeah, Bristol Social Enterprise.
Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
That's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast and has been broadcast on community radio stations in Bristol, Swindon, Preston and St Albans. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to this week's guests, Kevin Boylan, our very own Chris Searle, and those old enough to remember That's Life will know exactly what I mean there, talking about real lettings. £10 million of our money in a unregulated collective investment scheme. Then also to Carl Mann, looking at homelessness, his number 07459 412 418. And Belinda Kirk from exploreconnect.com. Thanks to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, or you can call them on 0117 909 6897 on the web at prsc.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.